Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical discussion, debate, dialogue, health and education, health and science in the news, and answers to your questions, both on the phone and via email. The opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I think let's just talk to somebody. Robert in Soquel, you're on the air. Hello, Robert.
How did you know my last name was somebody?
Everybody
morning,
is somebody.
Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
I'm calling to ask your opinion on seeking a, I hope I'm using the correct term, medical practitioner. For what could be a reoccurrence of plantar fasciitis, that the pain is centered more in the heel of the foot as opposed to the arch.
Okay, go ahead.
So I was calling to ask your opinion on what kind of practitioner or medical specialty am I looking for treatment?
Well, generally people with foot problems go to a podiatrist. This is a doctor of podiatric medicine.
No, I understand that.
So what? I don't understand your question.
Well, it could be one of the legs was diagnosed many years ago as being shorter. I think it was because of a hip access.
Right. Most of us have one leg that's a little bit shorter than the others. It can cause back problems. Doesn't actually that commonly cause heel problems.
Okay.
Usually what causes plantar fasciitis or heel pain in general, a very common problem, usually caused by tight hamstrings. So stretching the Achilles tendon and the hamstrings appropriately. A lot of people will wear splints at night, keep their foot at a 90 degree angle because we have a tendency to point our toes in sleep.
I've heard of that.
And so if the tendon's already tight and you keep the toe pointed all night long, it puts pressure on the bottom of the foot where another set of tendons meets. You can sort of think of it. The Achilles tendon comes down, grabs the heel bone, the calcaneus, and then all of your toe-scrunching tendons, which flex your toes, come and attach in roughly the same area. And so there's this huge tug-of-war going on, and whichever is the losing tendon, the weaker one, will tend to develop micro-trauma right where it inserts into the bone.
I see. Okay. So, thank you for that explanation.
Yeah, I think it's sort of like fatigue of the weaker tendon.
I am wearing an orthotic in this particular foot for pronation.
That probably is part of it, because if you think about what pronation is, for people who don't understand that term, that's when the arch collapses. So as you walk, some of the force of your foot rocks inward and twists, and so it's kind of a grinding phenomenon. And the tendency for people who pronate is that they'll flex their toes as they go into the liftoff part of the stride. They'll flex their toes a little harder, so you have a grind, string kind of thing going on in the sole of your foot. So it's going to put a lot of wear and tear on it. The orthotic should help. Stretching should help.
Okay.
Some people need to pad the sole of their heel. And I like a heel pad that has a hole in the center. And that's because the place where the tendons attach will often develop some calcium deposits there on the bottom of the heel. And it becomes inflamed and irritated such that just pushing on it hurts.
Is that called a bone spur?
Well, that's an old term, but yeah, and that's because when we got that brand new shiny toy called X-rays, they started taking X-rays of everything that hurt, and in people who had long-standing plantar fasciitis, they would have almost a claw-like talon sticking down off of their heel. Looked a lot like the spur on a rooster.
So they
called it a heel spur.
I gotcha.
But actually, it's not the cause, it's the result. So that's the causality versus correlation problem again. It's not the cause of the pain. It's actually the result of the inflammation,
which causes
both the pain and the calcium
that
deposition.
Makes sense.
That makes sense.
Well, thank you very much. I always appreciate your erudition.
Thank you very much.
Well,
and
thank you.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Jim in Big Sur. Hello, Jim, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
This call is about digestion. My mother used to always say, don't drink water when you eat meals. And more recently, I have read that you should drink water because it helps digestion. I've always had the feeling, well, drinking water will dilute digestive juices. So I take pills with water, often cold water, that comes out of the tap from a well after dinner. And I'm wondering, what's the deal with drinking water with meals? And how does that affect digestion, positively or negatively?
Context, context, context. So let me start with the fact that we are not all the same. And so while you can make a generality, it's about as useful as a generality about pap smears or mammograms. It still needs to be filtered to the specifics of the individual. Okay. That being said, if a person has problems with digestion, for example, if they have heartburn, that means that they have an open upper gate, the lower esophageal sphincter, which is the gate to the stomach, is impaired.
Right.
Those people, I tell them, don't drink water, hot or cold, or in fact any liquids with your meals, and stay away from soup, because you kind of want to keep the contents of the stomach as thick as possible while the stomach is doing its little washing machine routine, which is to say digesting and churning. So you put food in the stomach, it triggers the release of chemicals, digestive enzymes, hydrochloric acid, pepsin, amylase is coming from the saliva. Those things trigger the peristaltic action of the stomach, which is very much like a washing machine. Both the opening and the both openings of the stomach close down, and it all churns around until you've got a nice even mix of goo called chyme, which is a thick liquid, and that has an even pH all the way throughout. And then at that point, you start dribbling bits of this chyme out of the stomach and into the rest of the digestive system. So there's one problem, bad esophageal sphincter. Another problem people can have is poor release of digestive enzymes. So some people just don't make enough stomach acid. And obviously, if you have acid and you add water to it, you're going to dilute it down. So these individuals also will tend to do better if they don't drink water with meals or minimize the amount of liquid that they drink with meals. And in general, the older you are, the more likely you are to have problems with your digestive juices, with hypochlorhydria, it's called.
Right.
Okay. So that's a second group. And how do you know if you have hypochlorhydria? Well, there's various tests that can be done, but in general, the best way to figure it out empirically is to go down to the health food store and get some betaine hydrochloride. Betaine hydrochloride has hydrochloric acid in it. And you eat a protein meal, and just before you eat that protein meal, you take one pill, and you see if you get heartburn. And if you don't, then this is not, by the way, for people who always get heartburn. But for those who don't, then if one pill doesn't give you heartburn, then you try two. And if two don't give you heartburn, you try three. And if you can take four hydrochloric acid tablets without getting heartburn, you're not making any hydrochloric acid on your own, and you probably should take some hydrochloric acid tablets every time you eat.
Right.
And that's the simplest seat-of-the-pants sort of way of figuring out what your hydrochloric acid status is.
Right.
Okay? So two people who shouldn't drink water. Water with pills, warm or cold. In general, I'm more of a fan of tepid water or tap water rather than very cold water for taking pills. And you know, you're going to slow down the absorption of the pills, and it's certainly the dissolution of the pills a little bit with cold water. But most of that is actually coming from my Chinese medicine training. They just pound into you that cold water is actually hard on your system. It's hard on your qi. You have to use energy to bring the water up to body temperature before it can be digested. It slows the movement of the stomach, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So the Chinese are quasi-fanatical almost on the cold water issue.
Right.
And I'm kind of along the lines of there's probably something to that. Let's just use that as a moderation, not get too extreme, but I don't drink cold water. When I get water at restaurants, I ask them to bring me water without ice. Thank you very much.
So do I, actually.
Yeah, and I think we do drink probably an excess of cold fluids.
Yeah.
And maybe that's because we're so heated up by our high-pressure lifestyle and our high-pressure society and by too much caffeine. But in any event, the other issue with water, I think, is the other end of digestion, which is constipation. And anybody who's constipated, the first thing I say to them is measure the amount of water without caffeine that you're drinking. Any fluid that does not contain caffeine that you can read the newspaper through will count as water. So herb tea, apple juice, I count those as waters. If it's got caffeine in it, you can't add it to your total. And you should be shooting for about 2 quarts or 2 liters a day. And at that point, if the person still has constipation, come back to me and we'll talk. But the majority of times, that in and of itself is curative, particularly for young people. Older people have other issues, as I've alluded to many times in the past.
Right.
But for younger people, let's say under 50, it's almost always dehydration.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call.
Bye.
Bye-bye. I wanted to take a few minutes and just comment, as I said earlier at the beginning of the program, on the much ado about screening. And I'm very regretful. Ran out of the house in a bit of a hurry this morning and left behind the reference of a recent article in Journal of the American Medical Association. So I can't tell you which issue it was, but it's been within the last month. And there's a wonderful article about prostate and breast cancer screening that contrasts them with colon cancer and pap smears in terms of the success that screening has had. So I want to take this whole debate about screening to a higher level. By now, I think most of you have heard that there was a change in the U.S. Preventative Services Healthcare Task Force pronouncement guidelines around mammograms, and it said mammograms over 50 every couple of years, under 50, for between 40 and 50, probably not necessary. And that raised a great deal of furor. It's contrary to existing recommendations. And then hard on the heels of that, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology finally came out and said, you know, if you had a hysterectomy and it wasn't for cervical cancer, you probably don't need a pap smear. And oh, by the way, young women don't need a pap smear until they're 21. And that 3 years after first sexual intercourse rule we used to have, you can forget that one. And oh yeah, if you're over 30 and you've had three normal pap smears in a row, you can go to every 3 years. And if you're over 65, you can forget about it entirely. Well, does that sound complicated to you? My first comment to you when I look at those recommendations is, that's going to be so difficult to implement. It's already difficult to get young women in. And when you get them in for a pap smear, you're also doing sexually transmitted disease screening, which is a very critical piece that is completely left out of this discussion so far. I haven't heard anyone mention it. But let me put it this way. I pick up a lot more asymptomatic chlamydia, which is going to cause infertility, and venereal diseases in those young women coming in for their pap smears. And the thing that gets them in is that their mother says, you know, go get checked. You know, we don't want you to get cervical cancer. And so they come in and get checked. That's kind of the carrot. But what it's really doing is it's allowing us to do contraception intervention, and it's allowing us to screen for venereal disease. And if we don't see those women yearly, we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. As far as waiting until they're 21, you know, if you're promiscuous and you start having sex at 14, by the time you're 21, your tubes are already fried if you picked up a venereal disease, which means, depending upon how we go with this in the future, we may end up taking that woman and doing lots of infertility work with her. And oh, by the way, is National Healthcare going to cover infertility treatment? Let's talk about that one sometime. Anyway, what I'm saying is, in principle, that guidelines are just that. They're guidelines. They need to be individualized. And the fact that these came out this week, just before the history-making legislative debate on healthcare reform, it's either naivete or it's an attempt to short-circuit the healthcare reform process. I can't imagine that it's anything but. The scientists and the guideline people, they're sort of in their own little hermetically sealed world, full of epidemiology and statistics, really removed from the reality of human emotions and the political process. So maybe they were just being naive to think that they should put their guidelines and put their press release out this week. Maybe. Does this provide lots of ammunition for people who are in an opposition through any kind of healthcare reform because it's going to affect their self-interest? Well, yeah, kind of sort of does, doesn't it? It raises a lot of specters of rationing, and it's an irrational debate. We've already gotten to that. Coming back to the article in JAMA, though, I want to bring it to a higher level for a minute. When we talk about epidemiology and we talk about screening, as a society, what we first have to do is implement a screening program, and then we have to wait 5 to 10 years, and then we have to look and see if we saved anybody's lives with those screening programs. And 20 years would be better, because it takes a long time to show a difference in survival curves in people. And what we've got is, yes, if we do aggressive colon cancer screening, and we find polyps and precancerous or just turning into cancerous polyps, and we remove them, then wait 10 years, and the death rate from invasive colon cancer drops. Slam dunk, victory, okay. Same thing with cervical cancer. If you screen for cervical cancer and you find it, then you can remove it in its precancerous stages. The woman never gets cancer, she never needs chemo, and survival curves improve. So these are two great screening success stories, and we've got the 20-year data that shows it's true. And we can look at that data now, and with our new, better pap smear technologies, like the liquid phase PAPs, where the pap smear, instead of just being goo smeared onto a slide and then stained, is actually put in a centrifuge, in a liquid, and then the cell layer that is the one where the cancer cells are going to be is selectively taken off of that parfait of cells that you get after you centrifuge a pap smear and looked at so that you have a higher yield. That means you're more likely to be able to see the cancer. That means if it's no cancer cells or no precancerous cells, you can believe it. And it's reasonable to go to an every 3-year screening in any way, because cervical cancers grow slowly. So from the first abnormality on the pap smear to the actual invasive cancer is at least 5 years, probably closer to 10 in most cases. So you've got time to catch it. Now that's assuming, if we go to every 3 years, by the way, skipping your pap smear is bad, because if you're only doing it every 3 years, you better do it. And that's the other downside of these guidelines, is that they don't say that. That the whole structure of the logic is predicated on the idea that people will, in fact, get the recommended screening at the recommended intervals. And boy, let me tell you, as someone who actually takes care of human beings rather than statistics, that is a major, major if. Prostate cancer screening, PSAs, well, they haven't really shown a great survival curve. Yeah, we're checking PSAs, we're finding more cancers, we're taking out prostates right and left, and you know what? We haven't seen an improvement in the survival curve. Hence, the controversy about whether we should, going forward, be doing the same kind of prostate cancer screening that we are. And unfortunately, breast cancer screening, kind of the same thing. By doing more screening in the last 20 years, we've found a lot more early preclinical disease. Some of that preclinical disease, just like the argument with pap smears, some of that might disappear on its own. But we're finding it and treating it and counting it as a cancer. So cancer rates have gone up. But when you look at survival curves, they haven't. And now we come back to the hardest, saddest truth about this thing about, well, don't check women between 40 and 50. And the cold, hard facts of the matter are, if you get a cancer under 50, it's likely to be aggressive. It's likely to have already spread before it can be detected by mammogram. That's what the probabilities tell us. Aggressive tumors can't be found early enough to be cured, or at least for late-stage disease to be prevented by screening. And we have no way of knowing, when we treat early disease, what percentage of those would have gone on to become aggressive disease. But the chance is probably not many. Because if the answer were many, then we would see an improvement in the survival curve. And where we see the improvement in the survival curve is in the women over 50 with the slower growing, less aggressive tumors. By the way, just a little budgeting factoid. In women over 50, you have to screen 800 women for 6 years to find one curable cancer. 800 women, 6 years, bingo, we save one life. And as a society, what the guidelines say is that we're prepared to spend that much money to save one life. 4,800 mammograms for one saved life. That's a good deal. That's what the guidelines say. What about 40,000 mammograms to save one life? Not such a good deal. And unfortunately, that's about where we're at on the mammograms under age 50. Does that mean I'm saying don't get a mammogram when you're under 50? No. If you've got high risk factors, do it. If you've got sisters with breast cancer, if you've got several relatives with ovarian cancer, do it, because you get to be the 1 in 40,000, maybe, that gets saved. But should we do it for the entire population? That's something that we should be putting to a debate. We should be asking our scientists to tell us if that makes sense. And let's go to Patty in Perundale. Hello, Patty, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
Hi. I missed part of your show, so I'm not sure if you've already answered this question, but I heard a medical professional talking about pap smears and the fact that you can cause more damage in some people by removing cells that you don't necessarily need to remove if you find a precancerous condition. And then she talked about it in the context of screening for HPV.
HPV, human papillomavirus.
Yeah, so I was confused because I always thought that a pap smear was looking for precancerous cells, but she made it sound like they were looking for HPV.
Okay.
And I just thought maybe you could clarify that. And I'll take my answer off the air because I'm on a cell phone.
All right. Very good, Patty. Thank you. So starting with, I alluded earlier to the new technologies. Well, the new technology is both the liquid phase pap smear, but also the fact that we now have a decent viral probe. So we can look for the presence of high-risk human papillomavirus, 16 and 18. If you have that subtype on your cervix, if you're shedding that virus, then you are at risk for mutated DNA. And we know that because you've got active virus. So if you have that plus any abnormality on your pap smear, those are the women that we really aggressively look at now and do colposcopy and maybe do biopsies. Biopsies don't damage the cervix. Looking for the cervical cancer does not damage the cervix. The issue is if you find precancerous changes, you find late precancerous changes that are looking like they're going to head all the way in, then the treatments are either freezing the cervix with liquid nitrogen to essentially cause a burn, a thermal burn, and cause those precancerous cells to fall off, to die and fall off, literally. And the healing then comes in from other cells, stem cells effectively, which are not, we hope, mutated by the virus. And then the more aggressive treatment is to actually remove a chunk of the cervix. This is usually done under local anesthesia now using an electrosurgical radiotherapy device, which uses radio waves that vibrate at 40,000 hertz to vaporize the tissue and remove a chunk of the cervix, which then grows back, but sometimes grows back with a scar tissue called stenosis. And there is an association with more difficult births if you have a stenotic cervix. And there is also some evidence that fertility can be impaired, although it's not that high a risk. It is, however, a risk factor in infertility. So what do we do with that? I think the more harm than good debate is very important to consider. And I think as lay people, it is really, really important to understand that these are philosophical discussions and they need to take place at the expert level. You really, with all due respect, the public doesn't get a vote on this one because this isn't about democracy. This is about weighing risks and benefits and harms and looking at statistics in large groups and then trying to come up with some sort of general how to do the best job for the most people. It's a social utilitarian question and debate. When it gets down to the individual and the doctor in the exam room, then it becomes personal. And my best strategy has always been to talk about the risks, talk about the benefits, and give the patient a vote for themselves, which is the vote that matters for you. So I would present it, you know, if you've got a change here on your cervix, if I biopsy it and it's precancerous, we can monitor it carefully and do this exam, which you've just had once every 3 months, or we can do something ablative. With the ablation comes the possibility of scarring, and here's your probability. It's under 1%. But do you want to cut to the chase, get rid of this? Or do you want to go on fruit juice and quit smoking and behave yourself lifestyle-wise and try to cure this naturally? And I've had patients make both decisions, and I think both are rational decisions, and we should allow our patients to make decisions because ultimately they're the ones who are going to carry the consequences of the choice, not the doctor. But sometimes I think we forget that. By the way, the producer just popped up the article that we're talking about that looks at screening for prostate, breast, cervix, and colon cancer and compares the successes and failures of screening statistically is in the October 21st issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. The author is Esserman et al. So anybody who wants to go to the source, it's an extremely interesting, well-thought-out article, which is very accessible to the general public because it is a statistical discussion. So If you want to learn more, that's a really good place to start. And it makes it seem much more complicated, which it is, by the way. It's complicated. It's not soundbite accessible. And that's why I wanted to spend some time on it this program. And let's go to Phil in Gilroy. Hello, Phil, and welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
Doctor.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
Doctor, I have questions regarding heart attacks, all the symptoms, the complexity of it all. The last couple of weeks or so, I have started to feel heavy pain in the upper back. I already have back trouble, but this is entirely different. I've had back trouble all my life, and it's in the center of the upper part of the back. And it started there, and it aches, and it kind of starts in the center about the spine and radiates out into the shoulders. Then after that, a day later or so, started feeling the pressure in the chest and the tightness, which is another big sign of heart failure or whatever. Also, funny little feeling like somebody punches in the chest. It's real short. It's like somebody knocks the wind out of you. Periodically, I'd get this little, it's not pain, but it's, if you can understand what I'm saying, it's like if somebody punches you in the chest, you kind of lose your, knocks the wind out of you.
Uh-huh.
Getting that sort of a feeling just periodically. And it went on for a couple of days there. It seemed to get worse and worse. And I kind of panicked at last. I didn't know whether to go to the doctor or not. I finally went to it was late at night, and the doctor was gone. So I went into one of the clinics over here that stays open relatively late, and I got an EKG. Okay, I thought, well, I'm going to start with that. And the EKG turned out fine, according to the doctor there. Does an EKG pretty much tell you? I was thinking I was actually having a heart attack. And he says, you check, I'll find it doesn't say anything about a heart attack. What can you tell me there, first of all, about, my results being okay, but yet I still have these? And also, I started to develop the shortness of breath, which really scared me.
Phil, first of all, one normal EKG is reassuring, but it isn't all that helpful. And it definitely doesn't rule out heart disease. And I think people often make that mistake. An EKG at rest, you could have rip-roaring angina. I mean, blocked arteries, only 10% blood flow through an artery. And if you're lying down, taking slow, deep breaths, holding still, you might check out completely normal on your EKG and still be, one flight of stairs away from a sudden death event.
Okay.
So an EKG at rest is just the beginning. If a person has actually got an old heart attack, let's say you had a heart attack a month ago, I could do your EKG, it would be completely normal. If you are in the middle of the first 24 hours of a heart attack, your EKG could be completely normal. Somewhere between 18 and 36 hours, there's some very characteristic electrical changes that occur that are due to the fact that you've got cells dying off. And while the cells are dying off, the EKG looks very different. And then after that, when all the cells that are going to die have died, your EKG could appear to be normal. It very likely be different than the EKG from last year, but it still could fall within the normal range if you didn't have that previous EKG to compare with. So that's one of the continuity of care arguments why you want to go to the same doctor, why you should have an EKG on file so that we can compare it. And this is especially true for women, by the way. But I'm speaking to a male who, by your voice, I'm guessing you're over 55.
Yeah, I'm 60.
All right. So the first thing when you have chest pain, an unfamiliar sensation of chest pressure, is you really are obligated to prove it's not your heart. And the way we would go about doing this is, I'm happy that you had a normal EKG in the urgent care center. That only means that I'm not putting you in the hospital tonight. But my next step with you would be to do a stress test. And ideally a stress test with an echocardiogram, but even just a plain old garden variety stress test like most primary care doctors like myself can do in their office would turn up serious problems. Let me ask you, was this pain in your back and the chest pain more associated with exertion or with emotional distress?
Anytime I exert, I usually do. It does affect me. What I'm telling you right now, doctor, I've had this a long time ago. I can go back when I was 27 years old. I went to the doctor feeling all the pains. I had every symptom that you could have of a heart attack. And that's at 27 years old. I was working, and I was extremely stressed out. I'm always stressed out. Let me tell you this, number one.
Do you remember the story of the boy who cried wolf?
No.
Old Aesop fable, basically.
No.
The kid liked to, he'd like to stir up the village. So he would yell, woof, 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 and all the people would come out with their guns and, or, I don't know, pitchforks or whatever.
Well, a little bit. That, yeah. That
and then one day there was a, and then one day there was a woof and nobody came because they didn't believe him.
Uh-huh.
Well, the problem with chest pain in males is that the older you get, the more likely it actually is going to be a woof. And even if it's the same pain, it's nice to know that it's not a new pain, but I still think that...
So it's possible for people to have little heart attacks all through their life?
No, it's possible for people to have chest pain and have it not be a heart attack and then have chest pain and
I had more than the chest pain, though, doctor. I had all the symptoms.
Phil.
Okay.
It's possible. You are not going to talk me out of telling you to go get a treadmill, okay? You need a stress test.
Oh, okay, you're saying that I do.
Yes, that's fine.
No,
I'm
I don't mind
you
that.
I absolutely do.
I've got a list right here from the American Heart Association. I've got a whole list there, and it starts with the EKG, then it goes to electrocardiogram, then it says exercise stress test.
That's it.
Then it says exercise proposal. They got another thing. Mm-hmm. Then they got a medication stress test. Then they got another...
That's because we have a stepwise approach here, but you're not going to necessarily have to have all those tests.
Well, that's what I'm looking
for.
At a minimum,
what you need to do is you need to be exercising and stressing your heart and make sure that you don't get electrical changes that show that your heart is starved for blood under those circumstances. And if you can show me while you're having this whole symptom complex and exercising and no electrical changes, then I might pat you on the head and say you're okay.
Okay, so electrocardiogram would be the next step?
You've had that. I think you should get an echocardiogram stress test. Those are combined together in one.
Oh, they are? Okay.
Yeah, locally that's how it's generally done. Any cardiology office will do this. It's done by a technician. I believe that you should have that test.
Uh-huh. All right. But most doctors
Don't you have a primary care doctor?
I do and don't. I go to this place where there's they have a number of doctors.
All right. So Phil, we got some other people on the line. So to cut to the chase here,
okay.
What I believe you should do. You've called me asking for, you know, my opinion.
Yeah.
In circumstances, any 60-year-old man with any kind of chest pain, back pain, anything that's fishy, and this is fishy, gets a exercise echocardiogram or a echo stress test, echocardiogram and stress test combined, and then depending on those results, you decide to relax or go further. And that involves also an assessment of your risk factors. So you need a cardiology consult. At the very minimum, you need a primary care doctor who will order the echocardiogram stress test and be willing to work with you on assessing your risk factors. Some primary care doctors are comfortable with that. Some want you to go see the cardiologist because they don't want to be sued when you drop dead. That's up to the individual doctor and their risk tolerance. But you need to pursue this, okay?
Okay.
All right. Good luck to you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's say a little prayer for Phil that it is a false alarm, but I do hope that he goes through with getting it investigated. There's a famous epitaph on a tombstone somewhere that says, I told you I was sick, but a lot of people die of the opposite. Nah, I'll be okay and I'll wait till tomorrow. That could be on a lot more tombstones. Let's go to Melanie in Santa Cruz. Hello, Melanie, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
I have a stomach reflux. I talked to the doctor about it, and at various times I was prescribed pills, one Protonix, the other a little purple pill, which I forget the name of.
Yeah, go ahead.
On both of those occasions, it seemed like things not only didn't get better, but got worse with the pill. So I was very interested in your earlier discussion. If I understood you, you were saying that these kinds of reflux problems could be attributed to an insufficiency in the esophageal sphincter.
Yes.
And perhaps hydrochloric acid insufficiency rather than overproduction.
I want to clarify one thing, Melanie.
Yeah.
If a person has a bad esophageal sphincter and you put more hydrochloric acid in, it may backfire and worsen their symptoms.
Yeah.
So it's sort of an either or. If they're having a lot of heartburn already, then I don't go to the hydrochloric acid until I've reduced that symptom. And there's been plenty of shows in the past. If you just go and look for the keywords on the website on GERD. We've covered this issue in great, great detail.
Right.
But
the question I have is actually a little bit different.
Let me just say one more thing before you ask it. People who have heartburn symptoms while they're on a proton pump inhibitor may be suffering from bile reflux. Bile acids may be coming from the pancreas, from the gallbladder, getting into the stomach, and actually splashing up into the esophagus. And that is underdiagnosed. There's also something called eosinophilic esophagitis, and this is probably a manifestation largely of gluten intolerance, of wheat gluten intolerance, but it's like you're having a big hive in your lower esophagus, and it's not acid-related.
Mm-hmm.
So there are other things. The knee-jerk response in medicine today is to throw a proton pump inhibitor at anything that involves chest pain and see if it gets better. And then if it doesn't, then you have to actually use brain cells and think about it. Go ahead and tell me your question.
Okay, well, so here's the maybe weird question. The sphincter is a muscle, I assume.
Yes.
And have you ever come across anything to suggest that it is susceptible to operant conditioning?
Mm-hmm.
Just as we can train other non-voluntary muscles to do things if we want to.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible maybe to make the sphincter work a little better?
Well, I can't imagine why it wouldn't be subject to operant conditioning. It is a quote-unquote involuntary, which means autonomic nervous system mediated mm-hmm. behavior, if you can call it a behavior when it's not passing through consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you can. And sure, I expect it can be. I think that we actually are totally conditioned already. When we smell food, when we sit down at the dinner table, when we walk into the kitchen. I mean, I totally know I'm operant conditioned on the sight and smells of my kitchen. When I walk
sure.
in at night, I immediately want to eat something, even if I've been eating in the car and I'm not hungry. It's mm-hmm. just one of those absolute trigger things. It would stand to reason that there are things that you could do that would work, but the trouble is, how do you find a coupled behavior? I mean, when you set up operant conditioning, you have to have something that will trigger the behavior.
Monitor. Yes.
No, not necessarily monitor, but you have to have a way of getting the behavior, which is to say closing the esophageal sphincter.
Right.
And then you have to have your paired stimulus, the thing that you're going to create the association with. So I'm having a little trouble on how you would structure it. Could it be done? Yeah, I'm sure it is subject to it, but I'm not sure how to design something.
And you've never seen anything in literature about that sort of an approach?
No.
Which I would think would be more non-Western medicine.
Well, I think you're taking a Western medicine construct and imposing it on non-Western medicine forms. It's kind of like, yeah, you can look at it through that filter.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I'm not sure how you set it up to make it reliable as a diagnostic or, as a therapeutic intervention.
Right.
Interesting idea, though. Thanks for the question. I don't think it's odd at all. It's intriguing, but it's going to take some thought.
Well, I was thinking, when I said more Eastern, I was thinking some of the yogas who have brought autonomic processes under more control.
Yeah, that's true. I'll tell you what my natural approach in a nutshell to heartburn is. I get people doing all the right things in lifestyle, and there's a handout on the website that describes those.
Yes.
I have them use some kind of demulcent thing like deglycerized licorice or slippery elm or something that'll coat the esophagus so that they don't have symptoms. I put them on the hydrochloric acid with their meals and some digestive enzymes so that their system is unloaded and that mm-hmm. pasty chyme is very efficiently produced. And the hydrochloric acid also helps open up the pylorus, which is the other end of the stomach, mm-hmm. and dump things in. If a person's been on proton pump inhibitors for a long time, this same strategy will help them come off of it. And there's a lot of that on the website as well, so I'm not going to belabor the point. Have a good day. Thanks for the call. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we have time for Lee in Corralitos. What can I do for you, Lee?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I am calling about thyroid levels and hair loss, and I know you've addressed this issue before. I take 75 micrograms of Lavoxyl, and I've been losing my hair pretty much for the last 6 months. My TSH level is 0.18, which is pretty low for the normal range.
Yes.
But then I have these other levels also, and my doctor told me that that's what counts and that the thyroid level is not the problem. And the other levels are TSH called third generation, and that value is 27, which is still fairly low. And then I have an FSH, which is 80.1.
FSH?
Yeah, I don't know if that relates to this or not.
FSH is follicle-stimulating hormone, which comes from the pituitary and is directed at the ovary and affects the production of estrogen.
Uh-huh.
So it might be a factor as far as balancing estrogen and testosterone. Let me ask you, on your mother's side, are the men bald? Uncle, grandpa?
Balding, maybe. You know, not bald.
Top of the
male, receding hairline?
Yeah, top of the head with the sort of W where the temples get deeper and deeper. Okay, so that is hereditary.
Okay.
And if you've inherited that gene from your mom, because it's X-linked, you will thin when you get to late middle age, so between 50 and 65.
Right, I'm 59.
Yeah, you'll thin, but you'll thin globally.
That's what's happening.
It could be related to your thyroid, but with those kinds of TSH numbers, I would think that's unlikely.
Oh.
One thing you could check would be to check your total T3.
T3.
And look at whether or not you have a high T4, a high normal T4, and a low normal T3. T3 is the active stuff, and your body has to convert it. So the thyroid puts out the T4, everything's hunky-dory, or you take the T4 orally, again, everything's hunky-dory. Then it goes to the peripheral cells, and if the peripheral cells can't burn it, can't use it to make T3, or they're inefficient at making that conversion, then you could have a normal TSH and still be relatively hypothyroid. The medical term for this is euthyroid sick syndrome. Please don't write that down. But bottom line is, we were taught in medical school about this as a rare occurrence seen in the chronically ill and the elderly, and no big deal, don't sweat it. But there is a branch of medicine coming from the alternative wing and now infiltrating the ranks of the universities, because that's how this usually happens, saying, you know, actually, this T4 to T3 conversion issue may be an actual problem for some people and something that we need to address medically. So at the moment, just like with vitamin D and with, oh gosh, there's so many things where we start out academically with one viewpoint and then gradually the science changes our minds and we go, you know, maybe this alternative idea isn't so far-fetched, and it turns out it validates in the scientific lab, and then at that point it becomes standard of therapy, and we try really hard to forget that we were telling people it was nonsense 10 years ago.
Right.
And, you know, science marches on. That is the nature of medicine, and it's very frustrating. I'm going to editorialize here for a second. It's very frustrating to the layperson, because it's like, can't you guys just make up your minds? Why do you have to keep changing the advice all the time? It is frustrating because it's frustrating for me trying to keep up on all the new latest advice. And as we think something's going to work out really great, and then we go and do it for 10 years and it's like, you know, it didn't actually work. It backfired.
Mm-hmm.
So then we have to reverse ourselves. And it's all a big colossal experiment.
Right.
And it's navigation. We're navigating this sea of information and trying to navigate our best course through it. And it's not a simple job, and there are no dots on the pavement. You know, like when you look at a Google map and it's got the lines on the pavement that tell you where to go, you go outside, you look down at the street, and my goodness, where'd those arrows go?
So there's no, like, one perfect thing that I can just do and that will solve my problem, which is what everybody wants. I'm sure.
No, there isn't.
Right.
But, you know, I can point to a number of websites that will promise you that and sell you a nutritional product that will guarantee it.
Well, my doctor recommended that I use Rogaine.
Why not?
Think about that.
I think it's fine. What particularly if you have this mutation, because what Rogaine is going to do is it's going to block an enzyme that turns the testosterone into dihydroxytestosterone, which is the one that causes your hair follicles to shut down.
Uh-huh.
So it'll either work or it won't. And as long as you don't put it on irritated skin or a cut, you're not going to absorb enough into your bloodstream to drop your blood pressure. We're out of time, but I want to thank you very much for the call.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Don.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We've come to the end of another hour of Ask Dr. Don. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.